Welcome to New England Lacrosse Journal's Chasing the Goal podcast, the podcast for serious lacrosse players and their supporters to help further their development and navigate their way throughout their lacrosse careers. And now, here are your hosts, New England Lacrosse Journal's Kyle Devitt and Jack Piatelli.
Welcome to New England Lacrosse Journal's Chasing the Goal podcast. I'm your host, Kyle Devitt. Alongside me, Jack Piatelli. Jack, big day today.
Big day.
Huge day. We have Connor Busick from Cornell coming on to the podcast in a crazy time for recruiting, just in general.
Not only is it a big day, but it's a big time of year where the college coaches actually will be able to contact their recruits, have conversations with them, college campus visits. So really excited to find out what his plan is during this time of year.
Yeah, I'm really excited to ask him about the Ivy League and how different it's going to be, you know. And we've said this on past podcasts with other Ivy League coaches like Andy Shea. You got three freshman classes coming in. What's going to happen?
How do you manage it? You know, so much talent too in the Ivy League. Number of players haven't seen a lot of time or no time at all. Number of players haven't dressed for a game. It's going to be quite interesting to see how they manage their talent and get them up to the level they need to be at come springtime, not only to compete in the Ivy League, but to compete at the national level.
Especially Busick's role. Like, he hasn't even been a head coach. You know, he hasn't coached a game as a head coach at Cornell. Now, luckily, he's been an assistant, which helps a little bit, but, like, you know, I kind of was thinking about, like, it's kind of similar to, you know, being the head coach of a new program. You have that year, maybe two, to, you know, get your players, get everyone acclimated, maybe have some practices, and then this season is, you know, happening with Pitt with their women's lacrosse program. They're starting their season, you know, they're playing their first year, but obviously Cornell has better players. Connor's been there as an assistant, so he knows a little bit about the players, and he's got assistants there as well that know those players, and, you know, they probably worked out in gyms and whatever, but it's going to be an interesting year to see what Cornell does, especially how Busick is as a head coach just to start out.
The advantage that Connor has is he played there, and like you said, he was an offensive coordinator, so he knows what it takes to succeed at Cornell as a student athlete, and obviously he is a three-time All-American. But I have a lot of confidence in him, even though, and he's very young, he's only 27, 28 years old. But if he didn't have those experiences as a player and an offensive coordinator, if he had to come in now, it'd be very difficult.
Absolutely. And I think if there was like a new guy that just came in when Milliman left, just a new guy, had no experience with Cornell, maybe some of the Ivies just come in, it might be a different story. But I think that familiarity with him, Jordan Stevens even, and Paolo Saferi, who was a volunteer, I think a year, that 2020 or 2019, I think it was just 2020, but he came over, became a full-time assistant. That helps a lot.
Yeah, I'm just interested to ask him about being an amazing pro player, because that's kind of where I first kind of knew him from on my radar as someone that has covered pro for, you know, almost two decades now. I think one of the other things that's really interesting is he played there. He was assistant coach there. Now he's the head coach. That is like the dream. Mm-hmm. If you want to be a coach when you're a player, that's the dream. Like, Jack, wouldn't you want to be the head coach at the place where you played?
Love to be. Be a great experience. We probably win a lot of games, too.
Absolutely.
Maybe hey, be Clark.
Yeah, we'd be Clark every year. That's
I can't wait to announce what we're going to do for that game in 2022, but that will have to wait. Right now, we're going to talk to Cornell head coach Connor Busick.
Coach Connor Busick, thanks so much for joining us today. You're from Ohio, three-time All-American at Cornell, great high school athlete, football, lacrosse. How did you get started coming from Ohio playing lacrosse and then playing at such a high level?
Sure. So I grew up, spent all my time in Ohio except for summers. So I was born in Cincinnati, but played every summer back in Orchard Park, New York. So just outside of Buffalo. Both my folks are from there. So had a background in it, spent a lot of time there learning from, you know, some great coaches and, you know, playing with great players and You know, fortunately, as I grew older, so did this lacrosse scene in Ohio. And so by this point, it's pretty good. But obviously, you know, we saw kind of grow from the very beginning, where there was not much opportunity, to the point where it is now, where there's great coaching and great players everywhere. So I was fortunate to be around different people and you know, really get mentored by some of the best in the game. And that ultimately created some success for me, you know, long-term, due to starting at an early age and being around some great people.
I almost wore my Patriots hat today, but I couldn't do that to you, Coach.
Go Bills, baby. Go Bills.
Oh, he's part of Bills Mafia? Okay.
Love it.
I knew it. Oh, of course you do.
Well, I'm an Eagles fan, but Syracuse, you know, Bills are the second team that I got to root for. So,
yeah, what part of Syracuse you go to again?
The Hill, Syracuse.
Oh, was Newhouse?
Yeah. Newhouse, yeah. No, that. Ha-ha.
All right.
Anyway.
Connor, I know you mostly as a player, so that's where a lot of my questions are going to be. And as a player, I think you're this blend of Dodger and shooter that is exciting for nerds like me that love watching release angles and shot locations to try and figure out where power and accuracy come from. So I have to ask, that's like my first question. How did you develop that, like, high volume but like accurate, powerful shooting style?
Lots and lots of hours in the backyard. You know, that was what I loved to do growing up, and certainly something that you know, I had a group of friends who that's what we enjoyed doing. You know, we'd roll the balls out every day in the summer and just go shoot till you tore the net down, and then tie it back up and then tear it down again. And whether it was hanging a baseball glove in the corner and trying to tear it down, or just trying to hit spots on the net, it was something we really, really enjoyed doing. And it takes, you know, a million reps to get good at. And honestly, still to this day, you know, 7 years into my pro career, something, it's just a release for me. Go roll the balls out and go shoot and enjoy it. So again, it turned into a great skill for me, but it certainly didn't start as something that I was just trying to get better at. It was just something I genuinely enjoyed doing with my time.
Coach, how difficult has it been transition-wise, being a great player not only at the college level but the world level, transition to becoming the head coach at Cornell?
I think the time demands have been significant in trying to balance those and making sure that I'm taking care of both entities and doing them to the best of my abilities has been difficult. But from just a generalized coaching perspective, I think playing has been, you know, an incredible opportunity for me to you know, not lose that perspective, not lose the perspective of the guys, not miss out on, you know, it's easy to be a guy on the sidelines saying what was right and what was wrong, but being in the arena, being the guy that's making the decisions or making the plays, you know, there's everything on the spectrum from just making a bad decision because you made the wrong read to, you know, making the right read and missing the pass or, you know, throwing a bad ball or, you know, everything in between. And so for me, that perspective has been great to help keep me grounded and help keep me on the field at some level and understanding the way these guys are playing and what they're seeing. But, you know, like you said, as I've transitioned into a bigger role at Cornell, certainly, you know, it's been difficult at times, but I'm the luckiest guy in the world to be able to be doing both at the same time and, you know, have such great opportunities.
And I got to say, one of your most famous plays as a player came in the first season of the PLL, where you injured your shoulder on a drive to the net and then came back into the same game and score a goal in almost the exact same spot. Is one of the signature moments of the debut season of the PLL. And I think it'll go down in history as a signature moment. How do you feel about that play being your signature play as a player?
I think it's an interesting one from the standpoint, you know, you never want to look fallible and to have to come out of the game because of an injury. But, you know, I hope that's part of my legacy, is that I was a tough player that laid it out there and was there, you know, for, you know, 60 minutes in the MLL days or 48 minutes in the PLL days and gave all of myself and every opportunity I got to put the jersey over my head. So, again, I'm a little conflicted on that being the moment, but the defining moment, but certainly don't feel bad about it. I think that's the type of player I wanted to be, and certainly that personified it in some level.
That being said, though, what do you want your legacy as a player to look like, and how's it different from the legacy that you want to build as a coach that you're in the very early stages of doing?
I hope they're pretty similar, to be honest. And I say that because I hope that everybody that I'm around, you know, whether in the coaching, whether it's our guys or our coaches or other people in the profession, or, you know, while I'm playing, guys on the roster, support staff, you know, trainers, whomever it might be, you know, I hope they feel my gratitude every day that I get to do something I love. I get to do it with people I enjoy being around, that I'm going to give all of myself, and that every person, you know, goes into making an organization what it is. And again, like I said, whether it's our ops guy at Cornell or whether it's a travel coordinator for the PLL or, you know, everywhere in between, every role matters and every role is important. And I'm thankful for the opportunity that I'm given. So I hope, you know, the crossover of those two things that, you know, I'm a hardworking guy and hopefully, you know, accomplish a lot on the field, but that, you know, all those little moments build up and people recognize that I was appreciative for every moment I had a chance to do it.
You're in a very unique situation where you spent 4 years as a player, then you got your graduate degree and an assistant coach. Now you're the head coach. So you've been at Cornell for 10 consecutive years. Are you on your 11th year now?
Yeah, I think this is 11 now for me.
So you haven't left, and I know you love Cornell, and you were once quoted saying that not only did you mature when you were at Cornell, but you grew up. Explain.
Yeah, I think as most of us are, right? At 17 years old when you walk in the door, 18 years old when you walk in the door of college, you know, those 4 years are so impactful, and they should change you for the better. You know, that means you found the right spot. And so when I got to Cornell, it wasn't all, you know, roses and rainbows for me here. I got here and struggled. I struggled immensely in the classroom, on the field, trying to catch up to the weight program here, you know, whatever it might be. There was a lot of hurdles for me. And it was the first time that I'd really been challenged like that, quite honestly, you know, coming from a high school setting that was very competitive, but I was one of the best athletes and one of the best students, and a guy that thought I worked hard, but didn't actually understand that level of commitment and buy-in to struggle and get knocked down a few pegs. And knowing that I had it in me, you know, I made the U19 team before I stepped on a campus at Cornell, and then I missed the bus for the first couple overnight trips and away trips. And so those setbacks and those challenges really, you know, made me hit the reset button and reevaluate how I went about things. And then overcoming those throughout that first year and turning it into a very successful 4 years and, you know, eventually into the seat that I am now, it's given me an opportunity to grow, and it's humbled me in a lot of ways. But, you know, there's always been the support there every step of the way, whether it was my coaches, my teammates, my family. You know, you know that times are tough, and after you start overcoming some of those hurdles that feel, you know, immeasurable, things that you don't ever see the other side of it, you feel like it's too big for you. When you get to the other side of those, it just builds a confidence and a you know, a quiet determination that, you know, if you just keep chopping away, that eventually it's going to come to fruition. And so I've been fortunate to have that experience here on multiple occasions at different levels, from being a player to a coach. So it's certainly a place that's helped me mature, given me the support that I needed, but also challenged me in ways that maybe some other places wouldn't have.
So I think you're kind of in one of the dream positions of anyone that went to a school that they loved. They got a chance to coach. Like if Jeff Cohen at Clark University were just to leave tomorrow, I might call them and be like, can I coach? Can I be that? It's one of the only places I would ever consider going back to coaching for. So I feel like you're in the dream situation of every, especially young coach, because you still have that attachment. You still have that kind of, you're still making your own self as a coach, and you're having your own philosophies and having all these influences come in. How have you dealt with the pressure of that you put on yourself, and kind of with, you know, these, most Division I programs have the pressure of alumni as well. How has that gone for you?
Yeah, I think there's a lot of, you know, quote unquote pressure in a job like this, but I think a lot of it, you know, is generated internally rather than externally. You know, for me, this is a program I care deeply about. And, you know, I've given a lot to over the years, but it's a place that, you know, like I just talked about, has given me so much. And so the opportunity to pay that forward to the next generation of Cornell lacrosse players is about the coolest opportunity you can get, you know, to truly know that that's something that took care of you, that helped you grow up, that helped you mature, an organization, an entity, has surrounded me with the support that it has, being able to do that, you know, takes a lot of the quote unquote pressure out of it, because I know, you know, between myself, you know, our staff, our support staff, you know, we're surrounded by some of the best people in the business. And for me, you know, to do this every step of the way, with Jordan Stevens specifically on our staff and is one of my best friends and a guy I trust a lot. It takes a lot of, again, that pressure element out of it, that we know, you know, put your nose to the grindstone, you work as hard as you possibly can, rely on the people around you for support, and things will take care of itself. So again, there's certainly not to say there aren't sleepless nights at times, and there's not that feeling of, you know, we want to be successful. We want to be successful now. But I truly believe that, you know, when you lay your head on the pillow every night, as long as you gave it your all, things are going to work out. And so we're still itching for that opportunity to get on the field. And it seems like it's been a long time coming at this point, but we've got a great group in the locker room. We've got a great group in our staff room. And we're really excited to hopefully put that on display come the spring.
Coach, 2020 was a very challenging year for all of us. And I would say, especially for you and the Cornell program, there was a time, a short period of time, where you lost your trainer, Jim Casey, over 30-year trainer, well-liked and respected man, and a great loss. The head coach at the time, Peter Milliman, decided to move on. You were 5-0, second in the country. Season was canceled. You become the new head coach. How did you keep your emotions in check, and how did you keep the players and the program in order?
Yeah, it was a difficult one. You know, there was the passing of Jim Case was, you know, hit a lot of us hard. I think his impact on this program and everybody that's been a part of it over those 35 years that he was at Cornell is truly incredible. You know, he brought a levity and a sense of calm to everybody in our program, and to not have him at a time that was so chaotic and upside down at times was tough. You know, I think, you know, there's not a day that goes by in this pandemic that we don't miss Jim because of that levity that he brought to everything and the ability to kind of calm you down and make a wisecrack and give you a smile. So as we kind of got going, I think that first month was the craziest month of my life. You know, the turnover and the amount of things that go into just starting a new regime and making sure everything's in place, and the things that need to be changed are changed, and the things that just needed, you know, a touch point, whether it's a call or an email or a text, got those. And so, again, the support was overwhelming for us and our staff. And, you know, we wanted to make sure that our players felt that same support from our group, and the alumni were great, you know. And so for us, it was certainly a challenge, and I don't think it got much easier. I think we all thought we'd get through the summer and things would kind of get back to normal, and it really didn't. And so that challenge continued through the year. But, you know, now as we return here this fall, and today's our first workout of the year, we're excited just to get back to it, you know, to get back to what we know. I think there's as much excitement and enthusiasm surrounding, you know, this first workout as I've ever seen, and probably the first time we get on the field. And hopefully that continues to carry on. But just an exciting time for us to get back to some sense of normalcy and know that competition is not far away.
Yeah, I think it's interesting. I think if people don't know, the Ivy League hasn't played since that truncated season in 2020. And by the time the season rolls around, it'll have been 2 years. And you haven't coached a game yet, technically. How do you go through that process of building a new, basically a totally new team with what? Maybe three freshman classes that haven't seen the field yet. If you add everything together and you kind of put out some of those first games, that's got to be one of the most challenging things I can think of as a coach.
Yeah, it was interesting. You know, our advantage for, you know, again, I think when people look at a college lacrosse coach, they expect you to coach most of your time. And the reality is, even in a normal year, you know, that's not where you spend the significant portion of your time is not on the field. But, you know, with that being said, last year was even a, you know, that on steroids, where we did very little on the field, and we had guys all over the place. And so, you know, the most challenging part of that was keeping our group together. It was managing morale, was managing, you know, the psyches of 18 to 22 year old young men that were managing with loss and grief and You know, then adding on the piece of the season going out the window last year. So for us, like I said, you know, I think we spent a lot of time trying to manage that psyche and make sure that we were in a good headspace or as good as we could be and continuing to move forward. You know, we've been talking about the idea of a renaissance almost where we've been in darkness for 2 years now. And, you know, hopefully the way we think about things, the way we go about our business, the way we, you know, we interact with one another, all gave us, you know, it gave us some time to step back and reflect on all those things and hopefully improve our process for everything. And so now as we hit the field again, we hope that we're retooled, revamped, kind of rebuilding our culture piece. Cause like you said, we do have a lot of inexperience on our roster, even for guys that have been, you know, Cornell students for 3 years. And, you know, we're hoping to lean on our older guys to teach our younger guys. And we think our younger guys are rock stars. And so I think they're going to pick up on it pretty quickly, but certainly a big learning curve or a big experience curve, I guess I should say, to figure out pretty quickly. But a lot of, you know, a lot of confidence in this group, in our coaching staff to make sure that we get to where we need to and we're living up to the Cornell standard.
More with our guests in a moment, but I want to tell you guys about our new sponsor, Streaker Sports. Jack and I are in the studio right now wearing Streaker Sports t-shirts. If you're looking for unique lacrosse apparel, be sure to check them out. They've dug deep into the lacrosse archives to bring back some incredible defunct team logos and entirely defunct league collections, including MILL, which I believe is where you played, Jack.
Sure is. I have a New England Blazers t-shirt on right now. Very comfortable. Looks very good on me as well.
He actually brought in his jersey today to show me. And it's...
that like
it's,
a schmedium?
It was a little small, Jack.
Yeah.
Yeah, it was a lot lighter back then.
It's a little small. They also have NLL and even the short-lived American Lacrosse League of the 1980s. Got to check out their site. Look at some of these throwback logos. They're pretty incredible. They also have a selection of vintage collegiate lacrosse tees and mesh shorts and are adding more every month. I'm actually wearing today the Johns Hopkins throwback Blue Jay shirt, which if anyone has followed anything I've ever written in my life, I am a notorious, quote-unquote, Hopkins hater. I'm wearing the shirt now. You can't say that anymore. In addition to lacrosse, they have vintage sports gear across all sports and what they call sports culture, including movies like Slapshot, Caddyshack, and Mighty Ducks. Aren't you in one of those? No?
Caddyshack. No, I'm just kidding. In terms of Caddyshack, they sell a Caddyshack caddy t-shirt on their website, which is really cool.
Incredible.
Yeah, really cool.
I love it. For a limited time only for Chasing the Goal listeners, use code CTG20 at checkout to get 20% off site-wide at streakersports.com. That's CTG20 for 20% off at streakersports.com. Back to our guest.
Coach, when you say to your players you want them to play a brand of Cornell lacrosse and make us proud, what exactly do you mean by the Cornell brand of lacrosse?
I think it's as simple as, you know, we talk about inputs at Cornell. We talk about effort. We talk about attitude. We talk about focus. We talk about preparation and all the things that are actually within your control. And that's what we want to be dominant at. We want to make sure that our guys are playing as hard as anybody, you know, any team's ever seen. And I think we've had that reputation over the years. You know, the really successful Cornell teams, you know, in the last 20 years, in the last 50 years, are all teams that just kept coming at you, that were relentless off the ground, that did all the little things right, that didn't have, you know, didn't self-inflict. And so for us, that is the goal every single day, is that, you know, I don't know if we're going to be the most talented team that steps between the lines day in and day out, but certainly the goal is to be the hardest working team that steps between the lines. And that's the expectation from, you know, the first day of practice until the very last day of the season and every day in the summer, you know, that our guys are giving their absolute best in training, you know, creating that habit that every time they get a chance, it is full go. And, you know, we keep increasing that work capacity and hopefully overwhelm teams at some level. Again, not because it's so graceful and so pretty lacrosse, but because we're just relentless.
Cornell has a tradition of producing excellent professional players, Rob Pinnell, yourself, and most recently, Jeff Teat, who I also call Jeff Yeet. He's one of my favorite. Yeah. Thank you, Chris. One of my favorite players to watch play, especially now that he's in the pros. Obviously, you didn't really get a chance to coach him, but what is your best Jeff Teat story?
So I think one that I've gone to, and again, probably top of mind, was the Penn State game, the last game of 2020.
The best game of 2020.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yes.
Although we didn't get to see Jeff finish his career, I got a chance to, I was the offensive coordinator for his whole career here and had some pretty cool experiences being able to coach him and work with him in different settings. But, by the end, he's not a very vocal guy in the sense that, he's not a big talker. He's not going to say more than he needs to. But we're sitting in that huddle and talking. Basically, I looked at him. I said, do you want the pick over or under? And he said, want it over. Said, all right, we started drawing up the play that he knows well and that we've run a lot, a million times in practice. And I know a guy like that with, whatever it was, 30 seconds on the clock, spent 15 seconds just working, going back and forth, being patient, waiting for the right opportunity. And again, in that huddle, there wasn't much more than, four or five words spoken between the two of us. But knowing his preparation level, knowing his focus level, knowing the competitor that he was, you put the ball in that kid's stick and good things are going to happen. And so, pretty cool to see the confidence in his face. And again, all the guys know it, didn't have to say much, didn't have to do much, didn't have to pound his chest, put the ball in Jeff's stick, figure out exactly what he wants to do with it. And everybody else, I think when you watch that play, not a single guy of the other five were standing still. They're working for him, knowing that if they create opportunity for him or themselves, that, the ball's going to find their stick. And sure enough, hits a huge shot for us to tie up that game. And so, one of the more impactful guys that I've seen that truly just does it by example. He says a little bit, and when he says a little bit, those little things go a long way, and guys understand that. But a guy that just shows up and goes about his business in the right way, and I think that's what's going to make him a really successful pro for years to come.
Coach, you said that when you were the offensive coordinator, Peter Milliman allowed his assistant coaches to be head coaches in their position. How has that influenced you today as the head coach at Cornell?
Yeah, a lot of credit to him that he gave us a lot of leash to do our thing and to make mistakes and to try new things and to argue different points and think about things in different ways. And I think in some level, in coaching specifically, right, the young creative mind, when it's allowed to kind of go and make those mistakes, unlock some new ideas and unlock some new opportunities versus when you do it for a bunch of years, the lesson plan becomes similar. And again, I think a lot of guys do a lot of different things to keep thinking about it in different ways and keep bouncing ideas off of different people. And, it's why you see these coaching trees that get together frequently to talk. But, in our position and for me specifically, in my first coordinator role, having the ability to make mistakes and to try new things and to take ownership for that, right? The success or the failure of it, but also be able to play with different things was awesome. And so for me, going back to something like, the Teat Lock and, how big of a thing that became and quite honestly, my struggles at finding ways to get Jeff the ball at the end of that 2018 season and then going into 2019 and retooling a plan and no one really ever noticing that he was shut off, even though he was shut off for probably the majority of the time from there on out, I think was a success for me, but it certainly didn't come without it, without failure, without setbacks. And again, for my growth, I think that's as good as it gets when someone's going to put that on you to the success or failure. And then, A, failing and B, taking accountability for that and trying to improve it, I think helped myself and Jordan our growth as coordinators. And obviously going over to this role now, there is no safety net, that your decisions go and sometimes, and you gotta go out on the limb. But I think it gave me the confidence to do that in these situations now and in the head coaching role.
The last two summers of recruiting, I think are probably the most, let's say, active that they may have ever been in terms of just the difference in volume of watching film versus watching players in person, watching film and 2020 and watching kids play in person in 21. How has that impacted your recruiting style in the type of players that you're looking to pick up?
Yeah, I don't know if it's changed necessarily what we're looking for, but it's changed the way we could evaluate it. I think for a while we've prided ourselves on working hard and making the calls and making the connections and trying to get to know as many people that have touch points to these young men
as we possibly could, because, you know, ultimately when push comes to shove, what they do on the field is great. But, you know, the guy that's the best player on, you know, August 31st of going into their junior year may not be the best player by August 31st next year, but specifically 5-6 years down the road when they're coming towards the end of their career at your program. You know, the best player on the field today without the character traits that, that, you know, demonstrate the work ethic and the attitude and the ability to keep striving and overcome adversity. Those are ultimately your, you know, real markers of success, not necessarily if the guy is the biggest, fastest, strongest, shoots the ball the best on the run. Granted, that's helpful. You know, that's always going to help you pick up the phone, but getting to know these young men, getting to know their families, making sure they're cut from the right cloth, and knowing that they're going to face struggle. They're going to face adversity at this level. And so we want to make sure that they're willing to take that next step. And so, you know, in short, to answer your question, I know that was a long-winded way to go about it, but you know, I don't think it has changed much. I think the way we had to evaluate it, the fact that we had to work a little harder to get to know these guys because you weren't physically sitting on the, you know, on the field next to them, certainly added a little challenge. But, you know, specifically this summer, I think it went back to more status quo. It was more, this summer I was reading through some of the over fatigue and the overplay that these kids had because there were so many events now that people were excited to get back, which I certainly think there's some benefit too, but certainly, you know, you don't want to fall in love and out of love with a kid over the course of a month because you saw him every single day that you were on the road.
September 1st is the day that head coaches are allowed to contact recruits by phone, meet in person. How does that day start and how does it finish and what goes on in between?
Yes, and technically last year was our first go around as a staff at it, but obviously it was a little different without the in-person contact. And so this will be the first year that we can start having people to campus and sitting down with families in person. So, you know, realistically, it'll start with some emails at midnight, and we'll try to get on the radars of the guys that we feel strongly about. And, you know, some calls and, you know, hopefully some visits tomorrow. You know, it turns into a long day. You know, it's a marathon. You certainly get up as early as you can and try to figure out, you know, what you can manage. And because there isn't a whole lot of planning or scheduling that goes into prior to the first, you're kind of flying by the seat of your pants a little bit. But certainly we'll have a group of guys that we're excited to get in touch with, you know, as soon as we can, and then kind of let the day flow from there. But I imagine it'll be a handful of phone calls throughout the course of the day. And for us, you know, the hope is not to cast a wide net. The hope is to do our homework going into days like tomorrow, to know who we're, you know, talking to know what we're getting into, and hope it all, you know, works out for Cornell. And obviously that's not always the case, but, you know, we anticipate it being a process that takes some time. You know, we want them to know what they're coming into. We want them to understand the challenges that are associated with Cornell and the support that comes with that. Not just feel that, you know, Cornell plays a brand of lacrosse that they want to be a part of. And that's that. You know, I think this is a bigger process, and for these guys to understand all of what they're getting into is important for us, just like we want to know them very well. You know, we don't want to take commitment just in case, just to have it and then think that, hey, you know, a couple weeks down the line, maybe they have a good fall and somebody else comes calling with more money or whatever the case might be. We want to make sure that this is a pairing that we take some time and pour into that relationship. And it's something that we start now, and we hope over the guys' 4 years here that the relationship only grows with the individuals, with the families. And so that's what tomorrow is hopefully the jumping off point for those relationships.
I'm not a national recruiting expert, but I've gotten into it in the last, especially this past season here at NELJ. And what I've seen and what I've heard kind of go around is that this 2023 class is not necessarily deep, but there's so many impactful players in it at different positions. What's your overall view of the class as a whole, if you can give one, and how does that kind of fit into what you're trying to build at Cornell?
Yeah, I think there's some great high-end players. I think there's a lot of guys that are going to impact some rosters right off the get-go. But I think there's a lot in the middle area, you know, that's going to improve. You know, realistically, a lot of these guys missed their freshman year. They came back their sophomore year. They played, but most of them a truncated season. You know, whether it was just shortened or whether they, you know, maybe had contact tracing or whatever, and they were starting missing pieces of the season. And then they got into a summer, and the summer was, you know, full go. And there was lots of lacrosse, but I think even then
you develop some bad habits in the course of that. So I think there's a lot of long-term upside for this class. I think, again, the high end is the high end. You know, it's obvious when you look at a field, and it will always be the case. You know, this year, 3 years ago, 5 years from now, you're always going to look at the field, and you know, most people can pick out those guys that are pretty impressive. And I think there's a fair share of those guys in this group. But I think a lot of these guys are works in progress, and not that they ever aren't, but this group as much as any hitting that learning curve, hitting that experience curve that we even talked about with our roster. I think there's gonna be a lot of guys that continue to shine through, and you know, by the time they finish up high school, I think there's going to be some guys that, that turn out to be pretty damn good that maybe not everybody pegged as of tomorrow.
Recruiting process. How involved are you in the recruiting process, and how involved are your assistant coaches, and ultimately who makes the final decision? Is it you or is it all of you?
Yeah, I think we all try to be very involved. I think, you know, Jordan Stevens kind of heads up that process and does an outstanding job as a recruiting coordinator, where that, you know, the majority of the day-to-day management of it falls on him. But between him and Paolo Schifferi, and myself, we all try to be involved. You know, I don't think anybody ever gets overruled necessarily in this process. We all got to come to a consensus. So, you know, it's part of our summer plan that as we start to see guys, as we start to like guys, as we start to discuss who we like and who might be potential guys, you know, for like tomorrow, we have to come to a consensus. And so we'll do whatever we can to start moving schedules around and get guys where they have to be so they can get an evaluation, and then we can have a debate from there. But, you know, all three of us are actively involved in that process. Like I said, Jordan definitely leads the charge on that for us. But then when it comes to decision making, you know, sometimes there's a majority, but usually we try to get to a consensus every time and make sure that all three of us agree that, hey, it's the right guy for us and it's the right fit. And again, a lot of it comes down to the play is a significant piece of it, but I would say it's far from the biggest piece. You know, those character references, seeing how those guys operate, you know, having the relationships with club coaches, high school coaches, guidance counselors, whomever, that can give us the inside scoop on a young man, that tends to be the deciding factor more than anything.
Now, does your recruit, in terms of the number of players you bring in every year, like, does that change? And do you have a number you want to, or goal, a number that you want to get to tomorrow or within the next couple of weeks?
No, not necessarily. I think, you know, in terms of what we want to get to the next couple of weeks, you know, we're not, I wouldn't say we're even necessarily trying to fill our class, you know, imminently. Like I talked about, we want this to be a long process. We want guys to get to the point that, hey, you know, if I had the opportunity to go visit every school in the country and I had the time and the resources to do so, that, hey, take your time. Make sure this is the right fit for you. Make sure you're never second guessing that, hey, there could have been another place for me. You know, we want guys that come here and are all in on being a Cornell lacrosse player because they know it's the right fit for them. That deep in their heart, this is the right group and the right place that they think they can flourish and have a successful career and successful college, you know, life. But in terms of, you know, year to year, I think it changes. You know, some classes are bigger, some classes are smaller. You know, our group that just walked in the door is eight freshmen. And so that's obviously on the smaller end. And, you know, I think we get as big as 14 or 15 some years. And so, and everywhere in between. The goal is, you know, to flatten that a little bit. But, you know, the roster size and the long-term projection of who's going to stay on your roster and what it's going to look like and, you know, positional needs all play into it. But, you know, I'd say we'd like to stay somewhere in the middle. I'd say, you know, probably 12 is average if you look over our last six classes. But, you know, it can fluctuate based on that need.
Let's pretend Jack isn't here right now. What are his sons like, and what have how have they impacted your program?
Pietelli boys are awesome. I think, you know, all the things that we've talked about, right, are things that they've been through and things that they impact the rest of the guys around them consistently. You know, they're some of the hardest working, humble guys that you'll meet. And, you know, going back to talking about, hey, you know, the best guy maybe today on September 1 or tomorrow rather on September 1, you know, how do they manage the adversity of coming in and how do they manage the ups and downs of it? And so John's a perfect example. Came in and he started most of the games his freshman year and had his ups and downs. And the
adversity that he faced and his ability to just keep working, to keep working through the process, to go home as after his freshman summer and change himself and come back his sophomore year and be dominant. You know, I think he had 65, 70 points his sophomore year and was on pace for that again his junior year. And now to have him as a fifth year senior captain is incredible. And Brian's still finding his niche. He's one of those freshman classes that didn't really get the whole thing to play out. You know, he's five games into his career as a junior. And so he's got a lot of left ahead of him and a lot to continue to do. But you know, there's one thing that whether it's practice, whether it's a workout, those guys are going to show up ready. Those guys are going to be competitive as hell. And whatever you ask of them, they won't bat an eye. They're going to go do it. And then you're going to see them out there doing the extra work to try to get better at their craft. And so for us, they fit all of the character things that we're looking for. And that's not even to talk about how good of lacrosse players they are and how much they're ultimately going to impact this program on the field. So, you know, we're fortunate to have those guys on our roster and know that, you know, for Brian, who hasn't played a whole lot of lacrosse yet and has a lot ahead of him, and for John, who's, you know, coming down the tail end of the stretch, both of them make our locker room better every day. So we're lucky to have them.
Thank you, Coach. I wonder, you wouldn't think I was their dad then, would you? No, just kidding.
No, I almost said that. I didn't, though, because you're right here. And he can reach me, so I didn't say that. I'm glad you said it.
Coach, what is the plan in terms of your schedule for fall? And is your spring schedule going to look any different than it has the last couple of years with this whole pandemic situation?
Yeah, our fall actually, our fall changes a little bit this year, which will be kind of nice. We get a few more hours than we're accustomed to. So we're going to have a couple more practices. But ultimately, our fall will look pretty similar to what it has in the past. The plan is to scrimmage Maryland again this fall. They're a fantastic litmus test, obviously, as consistent as it's been in Division I over this last, you know, 10, 15 years. So excited to play against those guys. And then heading to the spring, it should be, you know, business as usual. Again, I don't think anybody has a crystal ball. And if anybody said when this thing started that we'd still be dealing with, you know, pandemic-related issues, I think a lot of us would have thought, you know, this would be far behind us at this point. But our plan is to play a normal schedule and have everything go off without a hitch. And, you know, fingers crossed that this thing continues to improve. But ultimately, you know, the plan is to make this year as normal as we possibly can. And it looks like we're on track for that.
I think one of the things that we talk to with a lot of coaches, and it's related to an article I have going up this week on laxjournal.com, the transfer portal. How does that impact you as an Ivy League coach? And is it less than other schools, or do you think it's more? And how is the Ivy League really going to navigate these extra years that these players are being given if they're not going to get that graduate year, or they might, or do you know the future of that?
Yeah, so the transfer portal is an interesting one. And I think with the collection of extra years, it will continue to impact programs. You know, you can certainly take guys out and have them on your roster. And if you've got great grad school offerings, then it's going to make you a favorable destination for some of those guys. For us, because we can't take the grad transfers, I don't think it'll impact us significantly. You know, we lost a guy in the portal this year for a grad transfer purpose because, you know, the program he was looking for was not offered at Cornell. And so we're excited for him and the opportunity that he has ahead of him. But outside of that, you know, the hope is it won't impact us long term. You know, the way this ultimately looks for us is our guys have to, this year there's a 1 year reprieve on grad school, but the expectation is that's going to go right back to how it has been, that grad students can't compete in the Ivy League. And from that standpoint, the need falls on our players to create an academic plan that allows them to exhaust their eligibility here. And so for most of our guys, they've already started working with, you know, their counselors and their guidance advisors to make sure that they're setting up a plan that creates the opportunity for them to stay and use their eligibility here. So, you know, John's a good example of that, where he's in his fifth year as an undergrad now. And we'll be able to play out the full year for us and compete this year. And a lot of our guys hope to follow suit. But as long as they've got the approved academic plan and it keeps them in undergrad, they'll be able to continue playing for us and hopefully use all the years that they've got piled up.
Coach, the player you were talking about was John Donville, obviously an outstanding player and a great character guy. Got to know him, watching him play at Cornell. Very impressive that you have two former players, last 2 years, number one picks in the NLL.
It's certainly a testament to those guys, but, you know, our program. I think, you know, those guys were as good as God, and they were fantastic leaders and teammates and all the things that we preach and talk about, and the same things we just spoke about with your boys. But couldn't be more excited. You know, I think the hope for us is to turn out great people, you know, to bring in great people and turn out great people. And when they're as talented and as hardworking as those guys were, you know, great things happen to those people. And so, you know, some of the things that I said in my pro career that I hope rubbed off on people, I know those guys are going to have a similar impact on every person they come across. You know, they're texting with him the other day. The first thing he said is, I'm just feeling grateful. You know, that he hadn't even been taken first overall yet. We were just talking throughout the course of the day and talk about how grateful he was and looking back on his experience and his time. And there's not many guys that are that talented and that highly regarded within their sport to be a number one overall pick. And the first word that comes to their, you know, their lips is gratitude, which is pretty cool. And so couldn't be more excited for those two guys. They're incredible ambassadors for our program. And, you know, I hope that that's not the end of those guys. I hope we have plenty more number one overall picks in the near future here, and certainly have guys of that caliber. So, you know, we just have to keep developing, keep pushing, but pretty cool moment for us to sit back and reflect on the guys that we've had playing for us over these last few years and looking at the roster now, knowing that we've got some of the similar type of character individuals with that same talent is pretty exciting.
You know, last one for me, the Ivy League is one of the toughest leagues to predict in this upcoming spring season. You know, you're a new coach. Jerry Burns, a new coach at Harvard. Again, we've got three freshman classes kind of competing for time. We don't really know who's starting at all. For someone that tries to prognosticate a little bit and push out and preview the season, I don't know where to start with the Ivy League. So tell me where to start.
I don't think anybody knows. And quite honestly, I was reading an article that was put out about us, and it was very flattering. But, you know, them talking about the talent of our roster, certainly I think we're talented. I think a lot of these schools in the Ivy League are very talented. But if you know what thing's going to look like when we get back on the field, you might know better than me. You know, I'm just excited to get out there. I'm excited for the challenge. You know, I think all of us are excited just for the opportunity to be back together competing. But, you know, the fact that we haven't gotten out on the field yet together and just started class a few days ago, I don't know if I can tell you where to start. So I think, you know, keeping a close eye on some fall ball scrimmages and getting, you know, the best read you can from there. But the one thing I can tell you is guys are excited. Guys are fired up to be back out on the field and competing again. And so I think you're going to get, you know, at least an excited version of Cornell lacrosse to start. And then hopefully we compete hard enough that we cover up some of those mistakes until we get back to being, you know, crisp and solid again.
Coach, a question I wanted to ask you for a number of years. What is it about number 33? You were in high school as a football player, lacrosse player, were at Cornell. Your brother wore it at Cornell. What's so special at number 33?
Yeah, so interestingly enough, there's not a whole lot. You know, I was always 19 growing up in lacrosse, and then when I got to high school football and varsity football, it just got put in my locker at some point. And, you know, there was a guy named Max Feely, who was a big part of me coming to Cornell. On my first visit, you know, I hit it off with him and thought he was an awesome guy, and he took great care of me. And he was an All-American defenseman here. And happened to graduate the year before me as number 33. So it was available. And so it seemed to only make sense to slide in at 33. And then it's kind of, like you said, become a family number. So Griffin wore it for his 4 years here, 5 years here. And so I think that that'll be it for my number. You know, one of those things that just happened to get put in my locker years ago and happened to all work out where it was available as I was coming in the door and knew I never wanted to change numbers. And again, a guy that impacted me and you know, couldn't be more grateful to a guy like Max Feely for helping me get here.
And you had the opportunity to coach your brother. That must have been a special opportunity for you and for him.
It was awesome. I got to coach him for all 5 years. And I think the first year we had to figure out how to coexist a little bit on a sideline. And at some point we got to that point and it was one of the coolest experiences I've ever had. And sharing the ups and downs of this thing and the adversity of it has only brought us closer and certainly an experience that I'll never forget.
Coach, we're out of time, unfortunately. Thanks so much. I know you've got a busy day ahead of you, But really appreciate your time and have a chance to talk to you today.
Thanks for having me on, fellas. Great to see you guys.
Good luck, Coach.
Thanks again.
Thank you.
Jack, Connor Busick coming in, dropping some heat on the podcast. Really enjoyed his responses. Doesn't talk like a young coach. Talks like he has a lot of experience.
Very mature young man. And I think having played at Cornell, having the opportunity to be the offensive coordinator, he's stepping into this new role as head coach with a lot of experience as a player and an offensive coordinator. He knows the school, knows what it takes to play at that level, and the commitment you have to make in the classroom, on the field, and even off the field.
Yeah, and you know, just the guys that he has coached that it, and he has played with in that program, to see him now as the one that is in charge of the entire thing. Just an incredible experience. It's got to be a great experience for, you know, his friends and teammates. I mean, Jordan Siemens, he said on the podcast, one of his best friends mm-hmm. is his assistant coach. Like, I don't think a lot of coaches talk about family, right? I think with Cornell, you're really getting that experience.
Yeah, we talked about Jeff Teat and John Donville being the number one overall pick NLL. He made a great point. It's really not how you start at Cornell. It's how you finish.
And I will say that both he and you on that podcast did just that, finished great. And thank you again for listening to the New England Lacrosse Journal's Chasing the Goal podcast. For Jack Piatelli, I'm Kyle Devitt. We'll see you next time.
Thanks for listening to New England Lacrosse Journal's Chasing the Goal podcast. Be sure to rate, review, and subscribe to the podcast on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, Google Podcasts, and other podcast platforms. Follow us on Twitter at NE Lacrosse Journal, on Instagram and Facebook at New England Lacrosse Journal, and subscribe to New England Lacrosse Journal online at laxjournal.com. That's laxjournal.com. New England Lacrosse Journal's Chasing the Goal is a Siemens Media podcast.